Hello and welcome to Failing Boldly, a podcast that invites people to share stories about failure, resilience, and perseverance. I'm Christian Kuhn, author of the book Failing Boldly and pastor of Urban Village Church in Chicago. My guest this week is Chicago mayoral candidate Lori Lightfoot. Lori has an extensive background in the law, including serving as a former assistant U.S. attorney. She's also been chair of the Police Accountability Task Force that was created by Mayor Rahm Emanuel and president of the Chicago Police Board. If elected, she would be Chicago's first Black woman and first openly gay mayor. We talked about the challenges facing Chicago and what it takes to run for political office. I hope you enjoy it. Well, Lori Lightfoot, thank you so much for joining me on the Failing Boldly podcast.
It's my pleasure.
I'd like to start by talking about your upbringing in Massillon, Ohio, and doing some of the reading about your own upbringing. It seems like it was a pretty, or what I read anyway, a pretty segregated community. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could just begin sharing about that and your upbringing there.
Massillon is an interesting place. It is absolutely fairly segregated, and I didn't quite appreciate that until, of course, I was older and left. But I grew up on a side of town that was mostly white, some ethnic working class families, folks whose fathers, uncles, what have you, plied their trade in the steel mills that populated the town. All of us were kind of scrambling financially, and certainly my family was, but we were one of few Black families that lived on that side of the town. And then there was kind of a predominantly Black section of town, and then there was a section of my town that was kind of upper-class white families. And we didn't come together as children, I would say, until high school, because there was really only one high school. So the elementary schools and the junior high schools kind of perpetuated were symbols of that segregation, and it was only at the high school level where there was mixing, if you will.
Yeah. Clearly, throughout your career, you have a strong sense of fairness and justice. Do you sense that you were influenced certainly by your upbringing in that context and
without
also from your parents?
Without a doubt. You know, I grew up, and after my brother that's closest in age to me left my elementary school, I was the only Black student in my elementary school, not just in my class, but in my entire school, for years and years. And that absolutely had an effect on me. I grew up in the 60s and 70s at a time that racial discrimination was still, unfortunately, very much on the top of the table, not sub rosa in a way, frankly, that it often is these days. I also learned a lot about equity and inclusion from my father and watching his struggle. My father was a deaf man all my growing up years. He lost his hearing early on in his marriage with my mother. He became gravely ill and was in a coma for about a year, and the result of that long illness was that he lost his hearing. So watching my father struggle to just fit in, even within our family. My father's been dead now 9 years, but I still have, we used to write each other notes on notepads. I still have, you know, pads and pads and pads of my conversations, if you will, with my father. I mean, he could speak, but he couldn't hear. But watching him struggle and recognizing that there were no accommodations that were made for him really anywhere was hard and absolutely affected my sense of justice and why we have to make sure that we have inclusion. I will also say that when I was in kindergarten, I have a very strong memory of a young girl who came. Her family were farmers. The town that I grew up in was surrounded by rural areas. And her name was Esther, and her parents brought her to kindergarten in the hopes that she could participate in schooling like any other student. But she had, I think, pretty profound learning disabilities, and there was just no accommodation, no place for her in our elementary school. And she's somebody that has stayed with me my entire life. And on the back end, seeing how kids with learning disabilities were really discriminated against in my high school. I mean, their classes were literally in the basement of the high school. That was an old building that literally, you know, There were no windows, no lights. I mean, it was a terrible environment for them, but that's where they were relegated. And you can imagine the horrible names that kids gave those students. So I just have grown up, I guess, because of my father, being very sensitive and aware of forms of discrimination and exclusion. And it's definitely something that has affected my life and really the work that I've been involved in and my desire to really help people and be an advocate for those who need to have their voices heard.
Growing up, were you always the child and then youth not only noticing and sensing that, but also wanting to do something about it? So asking, why is this happening? And then deciding, like, I need to act on this.
Yeah, I was a rabble rouser. I'll come clean. I was. And frankly, given where I was, I kind of bridged a lot of different social sectors in school, in elementary, junior high school, and high school. I was friends with people from lots of different cliques and groups. But I absolutely felt the need to stand up and be supportive of people that I thought needed to be needed advocates, but also, frankly, railing against things that I thought were, a problem. In my juvenile way, right? I was not like, and frankly, I'm so impressed with this high school students of today, where they're really taking on big, important, powerful issues. You know, the issues that my friends and I were railing against was, terrible food in our cafeteria and the prices that we had to pay. But yeah, that spirit of advocacy absolutely was ignited fairly early on in me.
Yeah. I want to talk certainly about some of the issues that you have talked about for the race for mayor, but I'm also really fascinated, not just by politics, but what is that thing that drives somebody to make that really big, almost audacious decision to go for this? And so I'm wondering, was politics part of something you thought you would one day do, or has that been a fairly recent thing for you to make that kind of big decision?
You know, look, I've always been interested in watching politics, not in participating, but in watching politics, because politics drives policy, and that's what I'm most interested in. But my path, if you will, in making this was really born out of, frankly, anger and frustration, and feeling like there were families that were like mine, not just from race or ethnicity, but in their financial status, that were really struggling and needed a leg up. Kids that were growing up in an environment that was very much like my own, but without the opportunities that I had to have a decent education and be able to take advantage of that. And it was clear to me, after a lot of inquiry, that they weren't being heard, they weren't being seen, and there was no plan for them. And I knew that if we didn't do something fairly dramatic and quickly to change course and really think about a comprehensive plan to uplift the quality of life of people in neighborhoods, we're going to lose another generation of people. And that was just unacceptable to me. And so, you know, initially made a lot of inquiries like, what's going on? Why is this violence spiking in neighborhoods? Realizing some of the underlying social issues and cost, really trying to get other people, frankly, to act and stand up and use their platform. No takers. And so I had to ask myself, all right, well, what about me? You know, what can I do to make a difference? Use this moment that I am in, this platform that I've been given, which is modest, to be sure. And that's what really kind of led me on my path.
Okay. Was that when you first asked yourself, what about me? Was it a long decision then to make the leap?
Oh, yeah.
Into, okay.
Yeah. I mean, you aspire to be the leader of the third largest city in the country at a time of such civic unrest, at a time of such great challenges with violence, with schools, with our fiscal situation, that's not something you do lightly. At least I don't. I like to think of myself as a thoughtful and pragmatic person. Plus, I wasn't in this by myself, and I'm not in it by myself. I have a wife and I have a child. We had to think through what the implications would be for them. You know, I had a very comfortable life with a very comfortable income. I knew I'd need to give that up in order to run full time. So this is not something you do quickly or lightly. I mean, there's a lot of thinking that has to go into it, and it had to be a family decision. We had to be united in thinking that this was in the best interest of us and the best interest of the city.
Yeah. I would imagine, too, and I don't know if this comes easily for you, but when you, especially if you're running for the mayor of Chicago, that you need to have a pretty thick skin, but also be able to comment on, call out people when you see failures either in the system or in leadership. Does that kind of thing come naturally to you in your experience as a lawyer and other things too? Or is it still, do you find it hard to do?
Look, you have to have a thick skin.
Right.
I'm a black woman from a poor family to whom nothing was handed. So I've had to fight hard for everything that I've gotten in my life. And so there's been a lot of doors slammed in my face, a lot of people who mockingly said no. So of course I have a thick skin. It comes with the territory of who I am. Look, I think the people of the city don't only want somebody who can do the critique, because that's easy. There's lots of things that you can rail against. What I think people are looking for is somebody who has a depth of courage and knowledge and experience and can articulate a vision that is different, and a positive vision, a way in which you can prick the consciousness of people, but also talk about how they can get engaged and how we can move forward together. So yes, of course, my skills as an advocate and being a lawyer come in handy, but none of that would make any difference if I couldn't articulate a vision forward and a path forward.
It's more than just saying that the system has failed Chicago and citizens, but it's also making sure that I have a vision strategy for making it better.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I read one article where you listed your top campaign issues as making sure that people are heard, citizens are heard, schools and education, high taxes in the city, and housing. And I know there are lots of issues that a mayor has to deal with. Are those still the top issues for you?
I would add in making the public safe. Public safety has got to be a top priority for anybody who's a mayoral candidate. And I will add that I believe that I'm the only one in the race that isn't going to have to learn on the job, because I come at this issue of public safety from a lot of different perspectives. Of course, as a former prosecutor, as somebody who's worked in the police reform and accountability space, and frankly, as somebody who recognizes that this is a public health epidemic, that we've got to get at the root causes of the violence and not just have a law enforcement only in first strategy. So I would add public safety to as the top priority.
Are those still, as you go out and meet with the citizens, those are still kind of the things that bubble up to the top, people asking you about?
Without a doubt. Yeah. And I don't know if that list included affordable housing, but that's also an issue that literally comes up everywhere that I've gone from the earliest days of this campaign, and now had two different forums that focus on affordable housing from a lot of different permutations. But that is a big issue. People want to be able to stay in the city, and we're quickly getting to a tipping point where if we don't do something fairly dramatic and soon, that people, you know, low income and middle class people are going to be priced out of the city, and that would be an absolutely epic tragedy.
Yeah, and I would imagine gentrification is hand in hand with that.
Without a doubt. I mean, I live in Logan Square, and we've been there for 14 years, and we've seen the evolution of the neighborhood, some good, some bad. But I know that my neighbors, who are renters in particular, but also families whose only asset is their home, are really being pressed. A lot of that, frankly, stems from the rigged and broken property tax assessment system that we have to fix if we're going to give people relief. But there's a number of other things that the city hasn't led on that they need to. By every estimate, we're down hundreds of thousands of units of affordable housing. There are whole sections of the city where there hasn't been a single affordable housing unit built in the last 15 years. That really solidifies segregation. We've got to break that up and lead in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to not just see people as issues and really see the lives that people come to you and say, I'm struggling with affordable housing, or I'm really worried about my schools, and really hear those concerns? I would imagine it would be easy just to kind of see groups of people and not really see individual lives of them, if that makes sense.
No, I mean, I think one of the most important things that's been lacking in the way that this administration has governed is really reflecting the lived experience of people in policymaking. That's critically important to me. I know in the work that I've been involved in on a number of different issues that you get the best results by listening. That's why I've said from the very beginning I'm going to be a mayor who actually listens. Certainly that was a critique of Rahm Emanuel, but it's critically important that you understand how people's lives are affected. The nuances are what's important and really make having impact, and you can't get there without hearing and seeing people, and a cross-section of people. People experience the same issues in very different ways. So having that perspective that comes from engaging people and listening to them tell their stories and asking, you know, probing questions has been one of the greatest experiences for me throughout this campaign. I know that by virtue of my candidacy and my status as a candidate, I'm able to get into nooks and crannies of lives in Chicago mm-hmm. that I wouldn't otherwise be privy to. And I know that that's a great gift. And I'm really trying to utilize that as effectively as I can to take it in, think about how policy could be formulated to address the concerns that I'm hearing from people, and then frankly put it back out to them and say, what about this? If we did this, how would that work? How would that affect you?
Yeah.
So that dialogue is essential.
Yeah. You mentioned public safety as one of the issues that you hear a lot about, and you certainly have had a lot of experience in working with the police department in Chicago and police misconduct. It seems like sometimes there is either or thinking when it comes to the police. Either people say we need to support the police no matter what, and those who say we need to throw them all out.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, how would you characterize your relationship today with the police department and all of the different ways that you have interacted with them in the last few years?
Well, I reject that narrative, that
right.
dichotomy that pits one against the other. I have a law enforcement background. I'm a former federal prosecutor. I worked at the Chicago Police Department. I have people who are my friends who are still, you know, quote unquote, on the job. And so I bring, I think, a different perspective to these discussions than maybe others. But I'm also probably one of the people, particularly in the last 15 or 20 years, that has held police officers accountable in ways that nobody else has. You know, I'm the person who insisted that if you lie in an internal investigation, that was grounds in and of itself for termination. There's a general or standing general order. It's called Rule 14, euphemistically known as the lie you die rule. I believe in that. I believe that if you are going to have the privilege of being a law enforcement officer, that you have to do that job with integrity, and that means not lying either by omission or commission. So I think you can walk this line that understands the importance of the department and individual officers to the daily safety and security of people in the city, but not having such a blind eye to them that you won't call out misconduct, that you won't call out abuses or excesses. We have to be able to do both and have that conversation. I think I've been in that space of navigating that world for some time now. I'm comfortable with it, but it definitely requires a calibration and making sure that you're kind of checking in with yourself and that your North Star never wavers.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, I appreciate your conversation about things like ethics and lying. And sometimes I've now lived in the city for 9.5 years, and there's a sense of conversations I have with other Chicagoans, we kind of shrug our shoulders at ethics. It's just, that's the way Chicago is.
It's so frustrating.
And yet, especially in recent days with all of the news about Alderman Burke. So say more about that when you say how frustrating that is.
There is a kind of part of the culture of the city where people think, yeah, that's a bad thing. I wouldn't do it. But what are you going to do?
Right.
It's been going on for decades. That applies to not only the ethics piece, which I'll come back to, but issues like, there are poor people living on the South mm-hmm. and the West Side, and they don't have jobs and opportunity, but what are you going to do? is that really my responsibility? Yeah, you know, our schools aren't up to the standards that they should be. And yes, of course we should. They're incredibly important to, you know, spreading opportunity. But what are you going to do?
Yeah.
That mentality is so pervasive, but it's also so incredibly corrosive. And it absolutely applies to the issue of ethics. You know, I'm like a unicorn. I'm a good government Democrat. I believe that you have to have integrity in doing the job. That's why we put together what we're calling the People First Pledge. And we had a number of aldermanic candidates join us recently in a press conference to make this declaration. But fundamentally, what I believe is, no matter what our policy differences are, no matter what our race, ethnicity, our geography, zip code, there ought to be some core principles that we believe in as public servants that are universal. And if we don't have that as our foundation, then we're lost. And so I will continue to rail against any idea that we can just cut and paste our ethics to fit the current fashion, and that it really is irrelevant to the political discourse if we have ethics or not. Mm-hmm. Deals being cut, favors being traded, stepping right up to the line of acceptable ethical conduct, maybe passing over it, maybe moving in a direction of legal conduct. We've got to change that around in Chicago. If we don't do that, all the other big ideas and important issues that we need to take on are all going to be for naught, because we're not going to have the faith and confidence of the public who are so cynical and jaded by what has been going on in machine politics in this city for way too long.
So when you say things like that, then, again, back to the average citizen, do they kind of look at you like, well, that's really wonderful that you're thinking that, but you sense that they really don't believe you? Or are you seeing a little bit of a sea change where people are like, yes, I think that does matter and that we can do something about it?
I think a little of both.
Okay.
But I think the continuing challenge is, you know, connecting up for people why the corruption, small c and large c, matters to their life. When you're talking to people who are living from paycheck to paycheck, who are worried about whether or not they're going to have good quality health care, what's happening with the future of their kids, this is not a top of mind issue. But what I've been doing, and people, I think, resonates with people saying it should be a top of mind issue, because there is a real tangible, measurable cost to the corruption and the dirty money that flows in Chicago. I mean, the fact that Ed Burke is able to have sole dominion over $100 million workers' compensation program, we don't know a lot about it, but I'm 100% confident that we're going to hear stories that are similar to what we saw in the criminal complaint, meaning in order to get, you had to give. That has a cost. You know, you should be able to access basic city services without having to pay homage to a baron or an alderman because you already pay your taxes. Mm-hmm. You're entitled to basic things as a human right, and yet they have to go and kiss the ring and pay more money or pay something else over and above what you already do as a taxpayer. That is affecting your bottom line, and it's something that is corroding the city.
Yeah. What is your response? It seems like the president especially has lifted up Chicago whenever he talks about anything that's going wrong in the cities or in the country. Sometimes he will bring up Chicago as an example. What is your response, not just to him, but others who talk about Chicago as a failed city or a city that needs a lot of improvement?
Well, look, I'm distressed by the fact that that has now become part of the national conversation around Chicago, along with the violence. I think it's a real shame and problem. There's obviously lots of really good things that are going on in the city, but the good things don't make headlines. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, we owe it to ourselves to vote our values and to choose leaders up and down the ballot who are going to take Chicago in a different direction, who have a different vision of themselves as public servants and a different vision of how they can serve the public in ways that truly put people first.
Mm-hmm. I'm always impressed. I preach on Sundays and I talk with folks after worship, and Sunday afternoon, I need a nap because I'm exhausted.
I'm sure you
are. And so for politicians or for people running for office, I mean, every day is speaking, having conversations. Are there days where you wake up in the morning and you think, I'm exhausted and I just don't know if I can go out there today? You do. And so I'm wondering, what keeps you going? What makes you resilient?
Well, I'm not going to pretend that I'm superwoman, because there are obviously times that I get very exhausted. But I have a carve out, you know, mind space for myself during the course of the day, certainly at night, certainly in the morning. I'm an early riser, so I try to wake up every morning and do things that feed my intellectual curiosity that are separate and apart from the kind of day-to-day demands of the campaign. I'm a huge sports fan. And even while I'm dismayed by my beloved Bears tanking as they did on Sunday, I do things and I have a life that exists outside of the immediate demands of this campaign. And that's how, you know, I renew myself. And of course, I really relish the time that my wife and I spend with our daughter and frankly with my friends that are supporting and rooting for me. But also, you know, I have a life that is bigger than this moment.
Yeah. Can I ask, what you talk about reading in the morning? Can I ask, like, what are the kinds of things that you read?
Well, I usually consume the local papers and the New York Times and Washington Post. I do take a peek at some of the political blogs, but frankly, I also read the sports pages. And I joined a couple of subscription services that are dissecting everything in sports. I'm excited about the college basketball season, so that's where I spend a lot of my time.
Okay. Well, I usually end conversations with folks asking them to share, because this podcast is about failure and perseverance and resilience, to share their own a time in their life when they failed or didn't quite do what they wanted. And so I was wondering if you could share a story, and that could be anything, personal, professional, as a child, in recent days, whatever.
Well, I think I'll answer this way. You know, I was a kid who was obsessed with getting good grades. And a B I regarded as a failure. And that mentality that carried through my, I'd say my 20s, led me to be much more cautious and risk averse. So there are things that I didn't do that certainly I regret and have really come back to me later years. So, you know, I didn't apply to some Ivy League schools because I felt like, you know, coming where I came from, I might not get in and that I would be outclassed because I didn't have the money. I imagine kids at Yale and Harvard were spending spring breaks going to Europe, and clearly some did, but I didn't push myself in ways. Similarly in undergrad and thinking about law school, I didn't apply to places that I'm now, with respect, with the benefit of hindsight, know that I probably would have gotten into. But I didn't take risk in my life because I was afraid of failure and how I would be able to process that. So luckily, over time, I've shied away from, or I've gotten away from being risk averse. I'm taking risk all the time, and obviously, this journey that I'm on right now is a risk, a pretty substantial proportions.
And public.
And very public.
Yeah.
But what I think about is what I get back from it personally. You know, I'm a person of faith. And I believe that we have an obligation and that God commands us to go out, not to proselytize in the sense of, you know, evangelicals, but to demonstrate to people through our efforts and our good work that there is a way out of no way, that there is a morning that comes even in the darkest of times. And so I'm trying to live my life in this very public way that gives other people hope and encouragement and pushes them to not fear failure, that even in failure you can learn a lot about yourself, a lot about circumstances, and use it to propel you to the next challenge.
Yeah, well, that's a good note to end on. Lori Lightfoot, thank you so much for giving your time and for this conversation.
My pleasure.
And that's this week's podcast. Thanks again to Lori Lightfoot for giving me her time for this conversation. As you might imagine, you can find her online. You can find her website and Facebook at Lightfoot for Chicago, and then on Twitter and Instagram, Lightfoot for Chai. Thanks again for listening. Hope you'll subscribe to this podcast. To learn more about my book and the ministry I'm a part of, you can go to my website, christiankuhn.com.